Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
If you look at the handout, the opening paragraph, which I will read to you, whatever begins has a cause. Big Bang cosmology tells us that the universe has a beginning. Therefore, the universe as a whole has a cause, that is, it is created. The syllogism seems simple enough, and it's attractive to many who think that cosmology offers a powerful argument for the universe's being created. Yet, other cosmological theories that speak of our universe as emerging from a primal vacuum without a cause, or of an eternal series of Big Bangs, or of our universes being one, only one in a vast multiverse, lead to an opposite conclusion. There is no need for a creator. It seems obvious to many that if the universe has a beginning, then it must be created. And correspondingly, a universe without a beginning is not a created universe. Cosmological apologetics sometimes leads to an affirmation of a creator, and at other times to a denial of a creator. But can cosmology really tell us anything about whether or not the universe is created? That's the focus of my comments. The simple answer is no. So, in this lecture, I will examine the confusion both in the various arguments for creation based on cosmological theories and arguments based on other cosmological theories that deny that the universe is created. Ultimately, I want to show how the analysis of what creation means, set forth by Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century, offers a powerful corrective to these confusing and contradictory claims. So first, cosmology and the affirmation of creation. Historically, Big Bang cosmology, which affirms a singularity or starting point to our universe, a point beyond the categories of space and time, and beyond the explanatory realm of physics, has been used to provide a kind of scientific confirmation for the traditional doctrine of creation. As we've seen, if there were a Big Bang, so this argument contends, then the universe began to be, and thus there must be a creator who caused the universe to begin to be. For Christians, the traditional reading of the book of Genesis, confirmed by the solemn pronouncement of the Fourth Lateran Council of 1215, is that the opening words of the Bible, in the beginning, mean that the universe is temporally finite, that the world and time began to be as the result of God's creative word. In what has become a famous address to the Pontifical Academy of Sciences in November 1951, Pope Pius XII claimed that, quote, true science discovers God in an ever-increasing degree, as though God were waiting behind every door opened by science. The Pope observed that the experience of the ancients provided human reason with sufficient arguments to demonstrate the existence of God. Yet now, with the great expansion of our knowledge of nature, again the Pope said, the vestiges of the Eternal One are discernible in the visible world in an ever more striking and clearer light. In discussing the discoveries of physics in this address, the Pope turned to cosmology and the question of the origin and development of the universe. He explicitly cited the discoveries of Edwin Hubble that point to an expanding universe of a finite age. And he drew a conclusion concerning such discoveries and the Christian doctrine of creation. And this is 1A on your handout, the Pope. It would seem that present-day science, with one sweeping step back across millions of centuries, has succeeded in bearing witness to that primordial fiat loss, uttered at the moment when, along with matter, there burst forth from nothing a sea of light and radiation. Thus, with the concreteness which is characteristic of physical proofs, it has confirmed the contingency of the universe and the well-founded deductions as to the epoch when the cosmos came forth from the hands of the Creator. Hence, creation took place in time. Therefore, there is a Creator. Therefore, God exists. In further remarks, the Pope did indicate that the new cosmology does not, strictly speaking, provide a scientific proof for the absolute beginning of the universe, and hence a cosmological confirmation of creation. Nevertheless, the Pope was suggesting some kind of correlation between Big Bang cosmology and creation. And the Pope's affirmation of such a correlation continues to be widely accepted among those who think that Big Bang cosmology points to the conclusion that the universe is created. The most famous current proponent of Big Bang cosmology's affirming an absolute beginning to the universe, and thus as providing scientific support for, if not actual confirmation of, the Genesis account of creation, that person is William Lane Craig. And I began the lecture with his straightforward syllogism. One, whatever begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe has a cause. It is created. Big Bang cosmology, in Craig's view, shows us that there's an absolute beginning to the universe, this kind of primal singularity that requires us to admit the need of a cause external to the universe, a cause that has created the universe itself. Related arguments between the temporal finitude of the universe and the conclusion that it is created can be found in the work of the Jesuit theologian and cosmologist Robert Spitzer. In his book, New Proofs for the Existence of God, Contributions of Contemporary Physics and Philosophy, Spitzer claims that modern physics shows us that the past time of the universe is finite, and since the universe has a finite past, it must have begun to be, and if the universe began to be, there must be a cause for this beginning. It must have been created. Here are some of Spitzer's words, and this is 1B on your handout. If there's a reasonable likelihood of a beginning of the universe, prior to which there was no physical reality whatsoever, and two, if it is a priori true that from nothing, only nothing comes, then it is reasonably likely that the universe came from something which is not physical reality. This is commonly referred to as transcendent cause of the universe, physical reality, or creator of the universe. As we shall see shortly, Spitzer refers to some contemporary cosmologists who defend the notion of the temporal finitude of the universe. Nevertheless, and contrary to Spitzer, these cosmologists reject the view that a universe with such a beginning requires a cause. So we have some cosmologists, contemporary cosmologists, we'll talk about Alexander Vilenkin in a moment, who say, oh yes, physics shows us that the past is finite, but the coming into existence of the universe doesn't require a cause. So that's a variation. I should add here that Craig and Spitzer offer, and this is 1C on your handout, a supplementary philosophical argument that employs a traditional Aristotelian claim about the impossibility of an actual infinity. It is a claim made famous by some medieval Muslim scholars, known as Kalam theologians, and reiterated especially by William Lane Craig. Briefly, this argument is that the very notion of an actual infinity is absurd. Any existing thing or set of things must be finite. must be the determined thing or set of things it is. Accordingly, if the universe were without a beginning, there would have to exist an actual infinity of past days. But such an actual infinity is absurd, following Aristotelian principles, according to this argument. Such an absurdity of an eternal universe, such an absurdity leads to the conclusion that the past must be finite. There must be an absolute beginning to the universe, a beginning that requires a creator. Now, further, in one of the seminar sessions that I'll have here at Yale, I will talk about how Thomas Aquinas rejects such a philosophical argument about the beginning. A crucial point to emphasize here is that the arguments using Big Bang cosmology to support the doctrine of creation link what it means to be created necessarily to the universe's having a beginning. And that word necessarily is important. For if you show that there is such a beginning, you have shown that there is creation. So number two on the handout, cosmology and the denial of creation. There are a variety of contemporary cosmological theories that refer to what happened before the Big Bang, or speak about an eternal cycle of Big Bangs with no beginning, or claim that the universe is but one of an infinite multitude of universes. A conclusion often drawn from these cosmological speculations is that without a beginning, it makes no sense to speak of the universes being created. Note here the same entailment between a beginning and being created that we find in Craig and Spitzer. But in this case, a beginning is denied, and thus creation is denied. But the same necessary connection drawn between beginning and creation. Surely the most famous contemporary cosmologist was Stephen Hawking. And I like to quote from his book, The Grand Design, that he wrote with Leonard Mlodinow. And this is 2A on your handout. Spontaneous creation is the reason there is something rather than nothing, why the universe exists, why we exist. It is not necessary to invoke God to set the universe going. The fundamental point is that there is no need for a creator, since science offers a more compelling account of the origin of the universe than does any appeal to a creator. Using insights from quantum mechanics, Hawking and Mlodinow think that space and energy, the primary components of the universe, were, as they say, spontaneously created out of nothing, their words. Note already that they speak of creation, if only to dismiss the need to appeal to some external agent. Contemporary cosmology for them eliminates any need for divine agency. Indeed, they think that to speak of a beginning to the universe makes no sense. This is the second paragraph in 2A from Hawking and Mlodinow. In the early universe, when the universe was small enough to be governed by both general relativity and quantum theory, there were effectively four dimensions of space and none of time. This means that when we speak of the beginning of the universe, we are skirting the subtle issue that as we look backward toward the very early universe, time as we know it does not exist. Time is something which occurs in a developing universe. For Hawking, nothing caused the Big Bang because there is no time at any putative beginning. Since time does not exist, he thinks, there can be no cause of the Big Bang. Essentially, you see, Hawking is denying the second premise in Craig's syllogism, namely that that second premise is the universe began to exist. Hawking thinks that the relationship between cause and effect is essentially temporal. That is, that any cause must exist temporally before any effect of which it is the cause. His cosmology allows for no time in which a creator could exist prior to the supposed effect. No time, hence no causal sequence, therefore no creator. Perhaps we can talk about the sense of causality involved here. Some cosmologists, such as Neil Turok, claim to have eliminated what they call the troubling idea of an initial singularity by positing an endless cycle of universes coming into and going out of existence in cosmic collisions. Gabriele Venziano, a physicist of CERN, describes various pre-bang scenarios that challenge any use of cosmology to show an initial singularity. And I'm not going to read, I have a text 2B on the handout from a recent book from a conference sponsored by the Vatican Observatory and the University of Padua in 2022 on space, time, and energy. And Gabriele Venziano has a contribution to it, and I quote from that text. Now, other cosmologists such as Alexander Vilenkin, and this is now going to be 2C, I'm going to read the text and then his paragraph. Huh? Alexander Vilenkin argued that the universe has a beginning, but deny Craig's first premise that whatever begins to exist must have a cause. So we have some who deny that there's a beginning. Now we have some science, physics, cosmologists that, oh yes, there's a beginning, but it doesn't need to have a cause. Quantum mechanics, Vilenkin thinks, offers an explanation of the beginning without any need for a cause. Vilenkin, famous for contributing to the development of an inflationary model of an expanding universe, claims that, quote, modern physics can describe the emergence of the universe as a physical process that does not require a cause. Text, what causes the universe to pop out of nothing? No cause is needed. If you have a radioactive atom, it will decay, and quantum mechanics gives the decay probability in a given interval of time, say a minute. There's no reason why the atom decayed at this particular moment and not another. The process is completely random. No cause is needed for the quantum creation of the universe. Vilenkin, who accepts a version what's called quantum tunneling from nothing, as a description of the origin of the universe, notes that the nothing in his account, quantum tunneling from nothing, that the nothing in his account is a state with no classical space-time, the realm of unrestrained quantum gravity, I'm quoting it from Vilenkin. It is a rather bizarre state in which all our basic notions of space, time, energy, entropy, etc., lose their meaning. In fact, Vilenkin offers the following thought experiment to get to this notion of nothing from which the universe has emerged. Imagine space-time as the surface of a sphere, and then suppose that the sphere is shrinking, like a balloon losing its air. As the radius grows smaller, it eventually goes to zero. The surface of the sphere disappears, and with it, space-time itself. Vilenkin, we have arrived at nothingness. We have also arrived at a precise definition of nothingness, a closed space-time of zero radius. This is the most complete and utter nothingness that scientific concepts can capture. It is mathematically devoid not only of stuff, but also of location and duration. However, the nothing, in some cosmological models that speak of the Big Bang in terms of quantum tunneling from nothing, that nothing is not the nothing referred to in the traditional sense of creation out of nothing. The nothing in these cosmological reflections may very well be nothing like our present universe, but it is not the absolute nothing central to what it means to create. It is only that about which the theories say nothing. As I've suggested, arguments from cosmology to a creator employ various notions of cause. Yet, physicist Sean Carroll, in his book, The Big Picture, on the origins of life, meaning, and the universe itself, says that, and this is 2D on your handout, He writes, causation is a derived notion rather than a fundamental one. It's best thought of as acting within individual theories that rely on the concept. The notion of cause, he says, is not the right vocabulary to use when thinking about how the universe works at a deep level. Carroll argues that the first premise in Craig's syllogism is false. Talking about causes, he says, is not the right vocabulary to use when thinking about how the universe operates at a deep level. Indeed, Carroll rejects the legitimacy of asking for a cause of the universe as such, and this continues, this is a long paragraph in 2D. He writes, why should we expect that there are causes or explanations or a reason why in the universe in which we live? It is because the physical world inside of which we are embedded has two important features. There are unbreakable patterns, laws of physics. Things do not just happen, they obey laws. And there's an arrow of time stretching from the past to the future. The entropy was lower in the past and increases toward the future. Therefore, when you find some event or state of affairs B today, we can very often trace it back in time to one or a couple of possible predecessor events that we therefore call the cause of that, which leads to B according to the laws of physics. But crucially, both of these features of the universe that allow us to speak the language of causes and effect are completely absent when we talk about the universe as a whole. We do not think that our universe is part of a bigger ensemble that obeys laws, even if it is part of the multiverse. The multiverse is not part of a bigger ensemble that obeys laws. Therefore, nothing gives us the right to demand some kind of external cause of the universe. Commentator Carroll, however, confuses one kind of causality, that between temporally separated events, with a much richer and broader notion of cause. Further, he thinks that causality follows from the laws of nature, which are somehow prior. When in fact, it is just the opposite. Laws of nature follow from fundamental causality. In rejecting the application of his restricted notion of cause to the question of the cause of the universe, he mistakenly thinks that he shows the falsity of traditional arguments for a cause of existence as such, that is, for an uncaused cause. Now, there are many issues here about the nature of causality that we need to ignore for the purposes of this lecture, but we'll talk some more about them in the questions, if you like. For now, I want to return to the question of creation and the beginning of the universe. This is now number three, Roman numeral three on your handout, my words, italics. If we leave aside the broad philosophical questions about the nature of causality, we can see that an important feature of the debate is about whether or not cosmology discloses a beginning of the universe. Stephen Hawking denies the intelligibility of such a notion, and others argue for variations of an eternal universe. William Lane Craig and Robert Spitzer claim that cosmology does indeed point to a beginning. The debate framed in such terms about a beginning leads the exponents either to reject or to embrace the idea of creation. Despite fundamental differences as to what contemporary cosmology tells us, all these views tend to identify what it means for the universe to be created with its having a temporal beginning. This emphasis on beginnings, even with Vilenkin's variant that a beginning does not need a cause, this emphasis on beginnings is indicative of confusion about creation. I would call this the error of beginnings, which leads to the beginning of all sorts of other errors. Number four on your handout, creation properly understood. Contrary to all these claims, that use cosmology either to deny or to affirm creation. We need to recognize that creation is a metaphysical and theological affirmation, and all it is, in whatever way or way it is, depends upon God as cause. The natural sciences, including cosmology, have as their subject the world of changing things, from subatomic particles to acorns to galaxies. Whenever there's a change, there must be something that changes. Whether these changes are biological or cosmological, without beginning or end, or temporally finite, these changes remain processes. Creation, on the other hand, is the radical causing of the whole existence of whatever exists. Creation is not a change. To cause completely something to exist is not to produce a change in something, is not to work on or with some existing material. At the very least, this is the traditional understanding of creation. This expression, creation is not a change, creatio non est mutatio in Latin. I tell my Chinese students and professors that I want them to mutter, perhaps sotto voce, under their breath, that Latin expression, creatio non est mutatio, on the metro systems, on the buses, on the railways, so that eventually 1,400,000,000 Chinese, including even President Xi, will say, creatio non est mutatio. And I have succeeded to some degree. But some degree doesn't mean 1,400,000,000. So when God's creative act is said to be out of nothing, what is meant is that God does not use anything in creating all that is. Creation out of nothing does not mean that there's a change from nothing to something. So cosmology and all the other natural sciences offer accounts of change. They do not address the metaphysical and theological questions of creation. They do not speak to why there is something rather than nothing. So I'm claiming here it's a mistake to use arguments in the natural sciences, including cosmology, to deny creation. This is precisely the mistake that Stephen Hawking and others make. But similarly, it is a mistake to appeal to cosmology as a confirmation of creation. Reason, as well as faith, can lead to to knowledge of the Creator. But the path is in metaphysics, not in the natural sciences. But if creation does not necessarily mean the temporal beginning, what then does creation mean? I want to flesh out some of the things I've just said. Already in Europe in the 13th century, the groundwork was set for the fundamental understanding of creation and its relationship to the natural sciences. Working within the context of Aristotelian science and aided by the insights of Muslim and Jewish thinkers, as well as his Christian predecessors, Thomas Aquinas provided an understanding of creation and science that remains true. One of the great intellectual debates in the Middle Ages, in Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, involved the examination of arguments concerning whether or not the world is eternal, that is, whether or not the world had a temporal beginning. It is a debate in the Middle Ages that in many ways anticipates controversies today concerning what cosmology tells us about the origin of the universe. The traditions of ancient science, especially that of Aristotle, inherited by medieval scholars, affirmed that indeed there is no beginning to the universe. Aristotle thought that there could be no first motion, nor a first instant of time. The universe, he concluded, is eternal. And that although for Aristotle there is no first motion, still there must be an unmoved mover that is the constant cause of whatever motion there is. Just as we've seen with debates in our own day, it seemed clear to many medieval thinkers that any affirmation of an eternal universe contradicted their belief that God created the world, and for the world to be created, it could not be eternal. Yet, from his earliest to his last writings on the subject, Thomas Aquinas maintained that it's possible for there to be an eternal created universe. Thomas, adhering to traditional Christian doctrine, believed that the universe is not eternal, but he thought that God could have created a universe which is eternal. Although reason affirms the intelligibility of an eternal created universe, Thomas thought that reason alone leaves unresolved the question of whether or not the universe is eternal. The development by Thomas of an understanding of creation out of nothing, and in particular, his understanding of the possibility of an eternal created universe, offers, I think, one of the best examples of Thomas's account of the relationship between faith and reason. Now, 4A on your handout. When speaking about the origin of the universe, understood as God's causing it to come into existence, Thomas observes that there are two complementary senses of creation out of nothing, one philosophical, the other theological. The philosophical sense means that God, with no material cause, makes all things to exist as beings that are radically different from himself and yet completely dependent upon his causality. This philosophical sense of creation has two essential elements. One, there is no material cause in creation, no stuff whatsoever out of which God makes the world. And two, the creature is completely dependent throughout its entire duration upon the constant causality of the creator. This philosophical sense of creation is the sense in which creation out of nothing is a subject in metaphysics concerning the complete dependence of all that is on a cause of existence. He's able to make this claim because of the distinction he draws between creation and change. As he wrote, and this is 4B on your handout, over and above the mode of becoming, by which something comes to be through change or motion, there must be a mode of becoming or origin of things without any mutation or motion through the influx of being. Notice that Thomas distinguishes between the mode of becoming by which something comes to be through change or motion from the more fundamental sense of creation that he identifies as the influx of being. The latter, the influx of being, is the causing of existence as such. Now that little phrase, as such, is important. It helps us to recognize the difference between causing something to come to be or to exist in ways in which, for example, animals produce offspring. That's one kind of causing of existence, between that type of causing and the causing of the actuality of whatever is, as it is, God's act of causing. Thomas, moreover, thinks that this philosophical sense of creation, that is, of God's causing the existence of all that is, he thinks it's demonstrably true. As he remarks, and this is 4C, and he says this in several places, not only does faith hold that there is creation, reason also demonstrates creation. I remember the first time in Shanghai, speaking at Fudan University, one of the top-tier universities of China, I was giving a talk, and I quoted this text, not only does faith hold that there's creation, but reason also demonstrates it. And I stopped. I said, you know, this is one of the more radical sentences in not only in 13th century, but in Western philosophical traditions to make this claim. And I said, now this claim is true, not only in 13th century Paris, but right here in 13th century Shanghai, with Fudan. And I noticed the students smiling and some of the professors looking a bit apoplectic. So I looked up at the ceiling and I said, you know, I hope the people in Beijing who are listening in recognize that this is a philosophical claim, not a theological claim. And it's important to see the distinction Thomas draws here. In speaking of the need for a cause of existence as such, Thomas is working within a rich Aristotelian understanding of cause, and especially of agent or efficient cause. He thinks that being, existence itself, needs a cause because there is an actuality, an active being that requires an explanation. Creation is not primarily some distant event. Rather, it is the ongoing, complete causing of the existence of all that is. At this very moment, were God not causing all that is to exist, there would be nothing at all. And by the way, all that exists doesn't mean it includes the taste on your tongue, the coolness of the evening breeze. Coolness exists. Nothing would exist. So all substances, accidents, properties, anything which exists in whatever way it exists can only exist if God is causing it. Creation concerns, first of all, the origin of the universe, not its temporal beginning. Indeed, it's important to recognize the distinction between origin and beginning. It may very well be that the universe had a temporal beginning, but there is no contradiction in the notion of an eternal created universe. For were the universe to be without a beginning, it still would have an origin. It still would be created. This was precisely the position of Thomas Aquinas, who accepted as a matter of faith that the universe had a temporal beginning, but also defended the intelligibility of a universe created and eternal. The distinction Thomas draws between creation understood philosophically in the discipline of metaphysics and creation understood theologically is what allows him to defend the intelligibility of an eternal created universe. The philosophical understanding of creation tells us nothing about the temporality of the universe. Whether or not the universe is eternal, that is, without a beginning, concerns the kind of universe God creates, not whether or not it is created. Whether the universe is eternal or has a temporal beginning concerns what kind of universe we have, not whether or not it is created. Now, Thomas also thought that neither science nor philosophy could know whether the universe had a beginning. He did think that metaphysics could show us that the universe is created, that is, has an origin, but he would have warned against those today who use Big Bang cosmology, for example, to conclude that the universe has a beginning and therefore must be created. He would have corrected Pope Pius XII or William Lane Craig or Robert Spitzer. Thomas was always alert to reject the use of bad arguments in support of what is believed. This is 4E on your handout from the Summa. That the world began to exist is an object of faith, but not of demonstration or science. And it's useful to consider this, lest anyone presuming to demonstrate what is of faith, the beginning, should bring forth reasons that are not cogent so as to give occasion to unbelievers to laugh, thinking that on such grounds we believe things that are on faith. Remember the second premise in Craig's syllogism, the universe began to exist. Thomas would say that reason alone, whether it be in philosophy or in cosmology, cannot reach such a conclusion. Hence, an argument using such a premise fails. The singularity in traditional Big Bang cosmology may represent the beginning of the universe we observe, but we cannot conclude that it is the absolute beginning, the kind of beginning which might indicate creation. After all, many cosmologists are now fascinated with the question of what happened before the Big Bang. Now, although throughout I've emphasized here Thomas's philosophical analysis of creation, I want to make a brief comment about his theology of creation. For Thomas, from a theological point of view, the temporal finitude of the world is crucial, not simply because the traditional interpretation of the opening of Genesis in the beginning supported such a claim, and that the claim appeared in the dogmatic definition of the Fourth Lateran Council of 1215. Temporal finitude is the basis for affirming that the created order constitutes a sacred history, in which events such as the incarnation happen in the fullness of time. The existence of the created order in its vastness and grandeur can be said to manifest the omnipotence of the Father, while the intelligibility of the created order manifests the wisdom of the Word, and the goodness of the created order manifests the eternal love of the Spirit. The created order is seen retrospectively in the light of faith to bear the impress of the mystery of the Trinity. The created order is the vestiges of the Trinity. This is Augustine's phrase. So for time, I'm not going to expand further on the rather rich theological discussion of creation in Thomas, because it's really in some ways not relevant to talking about cosmological apologetics. So, now in conclusion, as we've seen, some cosmologists have used insights from quantum mechanics to offer accounts of the Big Bang itself. They speak of the Big Bang in terms of quantum tunneling from nothing, analogous to the way in which very small particles seem to emerge spontaneously from vacuums in laboratory experiments. Thus, they think that to explain the Big Bang in this way, as the fluctuation of a primal vacuum, eliminates the need to have a creator. But the Big Bang explained in this way, quantum tunneling, is still a change. And as we've seen, creation properly understood is not a change at all. So even if quantum fluctuation makes sense, it's true, it's still a change. But creation is not a change at all. The crucial point here is that to offer a scientific account of the Big Bang is not to say anything about whether or not the universe is created. Also, we have the error of thinking that to be created necessarily means such a beginning, and that since Big Bang cosmology shows us there's such a beginning, this cosmology is evidence for the universe's being created. As I've suggested, the error on all sides of such cosmological apologetics is to start with the view that creation and temporal beginning must entail one another. And this is 4F on your handout. Those contemporary cosmological theories which employ a multiverse hypothesis or an infinite series of Big Bangs do not challenge the fundamental feature of what it means to be created, that is, the complete dependence upon God as cause of existence. An eternal universe would be no less dependent upon God than a universe which has a beginning in time. To be created out of nothing does not mean that a created universe must be temporally finite. Now, for one who believes that the universe has a temporal beginning, any theory of an eternal universe would have to be rejected. But a believer should be able to distinguish between the question of the kind of universe God creates, for example, one with or without a temporal beginning, to distinguish that and the fact that whatever kind of universe there is, God is the creator. So, no explanation of cosmological processes nor biological change for that matter, regardless of how radically random or contingent such an explanation claims to be, none of that challenges the metaphysical account of creation, that is, of the dependence of the existence of all things upon God as cause. Nor do any cosmological arguments prove that the universe began to be and therefore is created. One should avoid cosmological apologetics that seek to show either that the universe is or is not created. After all, creation is not a change, and even a universe without a beginning is still a created universe. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.